Well, it's really nice to be here tonight. It's really nice to be speaking to this group. Can everybody hear me okay? Yeah, I know there's a lot of background noise sometimes. I actually just got back a couple of weeks ago from a 2-month retreat in Burma. But before I left back in November, I had come to this group a couple of times where Lynn and Louisa were just starting their discussion of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Discourse. And I remember being so excited then that they were taking up this topic in such a thorough and serious way. When I got back a couple of weeks ago and found out that this discussion was still going on, I was just really tickled. I think it's so great that you guys have been spending this time on the sutta, because this is such important material. This is really the kind of Dhamma, the kind of sutta that you can really just sink into, kind of like a warm bubble bath, and just wallow in it. And it's not the kind of thing that you just read through once, or even really study in detail like this once, and then you got it, and you move on to other things. It's really a touchstone that we come back to over and over again throughout our meditation practice. So I hope you guys have been just soaking it up and enjoying it. I had actually been talking to Lynn and Louisa about coming to speak to this group a little bit for a while, so this seemed like the perfect opportunity to join in on a topic that I'm really quite passionate about. This is material that I really love. So tonight I want to talk a little bit about the Fourth Foundation of Mindfulness, the topic that's been under discussion here recently. And probably I will be repeating a lot of what you've already heard. But you know, you just can't hear this stuff too much. A little bit of repetition really helps. It helps it to sink in there, get into the gray matter. So the Fourth Foundation of Mindfulness is actually something that I've been thinking about a lot in my own practice recently. Back last spring, I had the opportunity to go to a 9-day retreat at the Bhavana Society out here in West Virginia. And that retreat was actually a Four Foundations of Mindfulness retreat. So there was a lot of meditation every day, but there was also a lot of teaching and discussion each day on one section of the sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And during that retreat, Bhante Gunaratna, the senior teacher there, made some comments about this Fourth Foundation that really put it into perspective for me, really put it into a context that I hadn't seen before. It's been almost a year since that retreat now, and I'm still really processing those teachings that he gave there. Because this Fourth Foundation is definitely not as accessible as the other three foundations that are talked about in the sutta. And I'm sure Lynn and Louisa have talked about it, because if you look at the sutta as a whole, this Fourth Foundation is definitely kind of the odd man out. But Bhante G gave it this spin that really made sense to me in a new way. He didn't use these words, but basically he described this Fourth Foundation as a contemplation of the facts of life. So that's how I've been thinking of it recently, is the contemplation, the exploration of the facts of life. There's probably a more elegant way of phrasing it, but that phrase kind of captures it for me. And there are other interpretations. This is just one way of looking at it. But it's true that when we're working with the first three foundations of mindfulness, we're really exploring our own personal experience at a particular point in time. Our own particular bodies, our own particular minds, and what they're doing just right now in this moment. So it's very specific, it's very focused. But when we work with the fourth foundation, then we're moving into exploring the more universal principles that apply to every human life, to all human lives, and at all times, at every point in time. So there's this progression in the Satipatthana Sutta from the personal and the specific to the impersonal and the universal. So the fourth foundation is about examining these universal principles, about exploring them and hopefully coming to understand them to depths that helps bring peace and freedom. To the extent that we don't understand how our minds operate, then we're really stuck kind of flailing around in life at random. We really don't know where we're headed. The Buddha said that when he looked out over the world, he saw that it was filled with beings longing for happiness, but for the most part, they were going about it in completely the wrong way. So it's possible to hear these teachings in the fourth foundation of mindfulness and think, well, okay, that makes sense, that's reasonable, that's logical. But in fact, it's one thing to understand these teachings intellectually, even to believe them wholeheartedly based on that intellectual understanding. And it's another thing altogether to really see them directly, to really learn them in an intuitive way in our own meditation. The wisdom of insight can be translated into intellectual terms. It can be expressed verbally in intellectual terms. But the reality of it really resides in a completely different dimension of our minds. It's a completely different way of knowing things. So one way that I see the fourth foundation is that it's encouraging us to bring these important Dhamma doctrines from the intellectual plane into the plane of insight, to be content to just learn them and memorize them, but actually to realize them for ourselves in our own meditation. It could be said that the entire practice of insight consists in confirming the Buddha's teachings. As you'll see in a couple of weeks when Don Kelly here talks about the Pali Canon, the Buddha really didn't hold anything back when it came to his teachings. He really spelled everything out in excruciatingly exhaustive detail. He used to say that he was different from other teachers of his day and that he didn't keep a closed fist with his teachings, meaning that there wasn't any special essential teaching that he held back. There wasn't any deeper mystery that he kept just to himself or to some small group of elite students. And if you look at the Pali Canon, this really becomes clear very quickly. The teachings are explained from every possible angle, you know, forwards, backwards, upside down. They fill a bookshelf, there's so many of them. And if you include the commentaries on the traditional teachings, the amount of information that's available is just really mind-boggling. So it's not that we have to discover something in our meditation beyond what we read in Dharma books or beyond what we hear in Dharma talks. All we have to do is confirm it. That's one of the blessings of living in a time and a place where these teachings are available, where we can hear them and take advantage of them. And it's also not a foregone conclusion that we actually will confirm what the Buddha said. That's one of the things that I really love about this tradition. It's really a skeptic's practice. It's about exploration and empowerment to explore the truth for ourselves and not just accept somebody else's version of it. So the Buddha said over and over again, life is like this, existence is like this. But then in the next breath he'd say, but don't take my word for it. Look and see for yourselves if what I'm saying is actually true. Ehipatiko is what he said in Pali. It means come and see. Ehipatiko. One of the traditional teachings about the Dhamma is that it invites investigation, that it calls one to come and see. And one of the factors of enlightenment, one of the very qualities of mind that leads to liberation, is in fact investigation itself. So what is it in this fourth foundation that we have to actually see for ourselves? There are these five fundamental doctrines that are included in it. And they're presented as lists. I think you've already been through most of them. but they're presented this way like many traditions that originated in ancient India for mnemonic purposes and from the days when these things had to be preserved through memorization and transmitted orally. So there are two lists of five, one list of six, one list of seven, and one list of four. And I remember that for myself as lists of four, five, six, and seven, with two lists of five, because there are five lists. So just as a reminder, these lists are the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the four noble truths. And those things gradually sink in over time. The whole sutta culminates with the Four Noble Truths, which I think is really fitting. It culminates with the highest teaching. But so how do we go about actually confirming these five doctrines? Or maybe a better question is, what does it mean to actually confirm these doctrines? So I'll offer some of my thoughts on this, and maybe you've heard other ones or have some of your own. So first the five hindrances, and for me confirming the teaching on the five hindrances means coming to realize that 100% of our suffering really arises from these forces in our mind, that really there's nothing else in ourselves or in the world that is actually causing, can actually cause our suffering. And again, that's something that we have to realize not intellectually, but on a deep intuitive level. Intellectually, I can say, well, yeah, my mind was really balanced, really at peace in and of itself, and nothing around me could really make me suffer, nothing could really disturb me. But intuitively, it's still actually hard for me to accept that my happiness or unhappiness is really 100% dependent on the quality of my own mind. And not only that, but that I'm ultimately responsible for that. That's really a pretty major proposition. But in order to see what's actually causing our suffering, we have to, first of all, we have to be able to tell when we're suffering. And it constantly amazes me how often we can be in pain and either to some degree be in denial of it, just unwilling to recognize it, or else to some degree just be oblivious because we're so distracted by more superficial things to the fact that we are suffering. So the training in the second foundation that you've already talked about, the foundation of feeling tone, waiting on the pleasure-pain spectrum, that's really important here for being able to tune in more and more easily to when we're really suffering. And then we also have to be able to recognize our mental states. We have to be able to actually detect the influence of the hindrances in the mind. So the ability to do that is developed in the training in the third foundation, where we learn to really tune into our mental states to see what they are and how they're operating. So once we've developed these two foundations, you know, the second and third foundations, then when we see that we're suffering, then we can mobilize this enlightenment factor of investigation, and we can look and see what's going on with our mental states. Is craving present? Is aversion present? Are we confused? Are we lethargic? Are we agitated? Because one of these five very fundamental forces is the root of our suffering. So that's not thinking about the pain. That's not analyzing where it might be coming from, or why, or what it has to do with our childhoods, our current conflict at work. It's not any of that. But it's actually feeling the quality of mind that's driving the suffering, and tracing the source of the suffering back in a very intuitive, nonverbal way. And again, this is not to look with the preconception that we're going to find one of the five hindrances at the root of our suffering. We want to be aware that we might find one from there, but it's really to look with interest and an open mind at what is the source of my pain right now, what's really happening, And this isn't something that we get by just seeing it once. We see it over and over and over again in our meditation, and gradually it begins to sink in what the causes of our suffering truly are. And we may also come to intellectual acceptance of this doctrine long before we've seen it intuitively for ourselves. It's not that the intellectual understanding is wrong, it's just not a substitute for actual insight. So after the five hindrances come the five aggregates and the six sense bases. And I want to talk about these two together because they're actually very intimately connected, they're very closely related, because they're two versions of the same basic teaching on mind and body, which is called nama and rupa in Pali. Nama is mentality and rupa is materiality. So, for example, in Burma, when you buy a Buddha image, you know, a Buddha statue, it's actually called the Buddha rupa, a Buddha body. One of the most fundamental teachings of the Buddha was that what we call the world, or life, or me, is really nothing more than this series of impersonal, physical, and mental phenomena unfolding moment by moment. There's really nothing else. Anything that we think of as an entity, an object, even an event, is really just constructed out of these basic building blocks of instantaneous physical and mental phenomena. So these two doctrines, the six sense bases and the five aggregates, just carve up mental and physical phenomena in slightly different ways. So the doctrine of the five aggregates takes all physical phenomena just as one category, the physical aggregate, the body aggregate, and then it slices up the mentality part of experience into these four subcategories, the consciousness, feeling, perception, and then kind of everything else, mental formations. Whereas the doctrine on the six sense bases does it the other way around. It takes all mentality just as one category, the mind door, and then it slices up physical experience into five subcategories, one for each of the physical senses. So they're really just kind of carving things up in somewhat different ways, but it's the same basic teaching. It's said that the Buddha would use whichever of these schemes was most compatible with a particular student's temperament. So if somebody was more attached to their body, then he might talk about the six sense bases, which kind of gives more airtime to the body, to the details of the body. Whereas if somebody was more attached to their mind, then he might talk about the five aggregates, which goes into a little bit more depth with mentality and treats that with more detail. But what we're looking to confirm here with these two doctrines is that these various classes of physical and mental phenomena really do constitute 100% of our experience, that really there is nothing else. Whatever the specific experience of the moment might be, it always falls into one of the six sense bases and one of the five aggregates. There's really absolutely nothing else that ever happens. So it could be said that human beings are effectively six-dimensional creatures. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and cognizing, and their mental activity, are the aspects of reality that you can perceive. And that's it. You know, other creatures have access to different aspects of reality, of physical reality. I think I've heard that like elephants listen to really deep sound frequencies that we can't hear, and bats, I think, listen to really high ones, like ultrasound, and some creatures can pick up, like, electrical fields, things like that, but all of that is invisible to us, all of that lies outside of our sensory experience. The portions of the physical world that directly affect our nervous systems are really quite limited. Specifically, there's five of them, and we all know them quite well. The mental territory that we can cover is really actually quite broader. We may not be able to go to the moon with our bodies, but we can certainly go there with our minds. There's thoughts, feelings, perceptions, emotions, all sorts of things. And maybe that's why we get so caught up in our mental experience. But even our vast mental life still falls completely within the four classes of mentality described in the five aggregates. We can develop and refine our minds through various kinds of training, through study, through meditation, art, yoga. There's all sorts of very skillful things we can do to develop our minds. So we can influence the quality of what's going on in our minds. And it's important to do that. But even for a fully enlightened being, mental experience still consists just of consciousness, perceptions, feelings, and other mental formations. There's just nothing else that ever happens in our minds. And it's really tremendously freeing to be able to switch filters and learn to see our lives from these alternate perspectives. That's how we confirm this. By seeing for ourselves that these are really valid and accurate ways of viewing reality. Seeing things in this way in our own meditation is really radical. It really starts to weaken our obsession with our own personalities and our own lives in a way that just can't be accomplished intellectually. So in order to really see these two doctrines in action, we have to also be able to clearly and precisely separate out our various physical mental experiences. So again, the first three foundations of mindfulness that we've already talked about really prepare us for that. They train us to look closely at our body and to look closely at our mind and be really clear about what exactly is going on. And once we've got the hang of this kind of way of seeing things, then we may choose to practice this way at times. Or we may just spontaneously become aware of things from this perspective also. So instead of being aware of particular physical or mental phenomena, we may be aware of the aggregate that they belong to, or the sense store that they're arising at, kind of a more general, personal truth of them, rather than the specifics. So instead of noticing burning or tightness in the body, we may just tune into the fact that it's the physical aggregate that we're noticing, or that it's the body base that's active. Or instead of noticing the particular content or quality of the thought, we may just notice that it's the mind door that's active, or that it's the mentality aggregate that we're aware of. So after the aggregates and the sense bases comes the seven factors of enlightenment. This is where the training in mindfulness that's presented in the sutta really starts to get close to the goal of peace and freedom. Because these are the forces in the mind that actually lead to peace and freedom. And that's what it is that we have to confirm for ourselves about this doctrine. That it's by developing and balancing these forces in the mind that we can break free of our suffering. When these seven factors really become strong and balanced in the mind, that it's actually free from suffering automatically. We couldn't stop it if we wanted to. And we also can't do it any other way. There are no shortcuts and there are really no alternatives. This is the only path to freedom from suffering. So that's a very strong statement that I'm making, that there's only this one path to liberation, and it's through these seven particular mental factors. And again, this is something that we each need to investigate for ourselves. It's not something to either accept or reject as doctrine, but really to look into and investigate. One thing that really bolsters my faith in this doctrine is that it doesn't include anything that's specifically Buddhist. There's no mention of having faith in the Buddha or the Triple Gem or observing any particular rituals or even any particular meditation. So this doctrine that's specifically about liberation doesn't insist in any way on any particular observance or belief. It's really completely ecumenical. all it says is that whatever our spiritual path might be, if it's going to be effective, it's going to have to develop and balance these seven factors of mind. Whether it's the Satipatthana meditation that we're doing, Vipassana meditation, or whether it's some other meditation, or whether it's some other religious tradition entirely. If it's going to actually lead us to peace, then it's going to have to follow a route that includes these seven factors. So the first step towards being able to actually confirm this is learning to recognize when these mental factors are present, to what degree, much like with the hindrances. So the training in the third foundation of consciousness and mental states is particularly important here. We spend a lot of time early in our practice learning to recognize and work with the hindrances because they're kind of the squeaky wheels that were called most aggressively for our attention. But it's important to remember to also keep an eye out for the more subtle qualities of the seven factors of enlightenment. These mental states can often slip below the radar, especially if we're used to a lot of drama and confusion in our minds. When things calm down a little bit, it's important to recognize that calm, however brief, because calm is one of the factors that will lead us to freedom from suffering. We need to learn to recognize concentration and equanimity when they arise, and energy and joy and investigation, and of course mindfulness we're learning about all the time in our practice. But the more that we can be aware of these qualities, the more we can develop a taste for them. It's ironic that they are a bit of an acquired taste for most of us. Especially in this society, we really tend to get trained to be addicted to excitement, to intensity. So peace and freedom is not actually where most of us are accustomed to looking for gratification in our lives. So another thing that we have to confirm for ourselves is just how delicious the kind of happiness that comes from the presence of these seven factors of enlightenment actually is. That the happiness of peace that comes from freedom from craving is actually superior to the kind of intense euphoric joy that comes from the satisfaction. And again, we may accept this intellectually or not, but the actual experience of this kind of happiness has nothing to do with intellectual understanding. It's really quite revolutionary when we experience it. Because once we get a taste of it, we naturally start to shift the goal of our activities in life, often without even realizing it, away from the satisfaction of desires and toward freedom from desires. That's really a big shift in the way we think about life and the way we orient our life. And when we experience it directly, we do this not because we think we ought to, but because we really want to, because we really actually see for ourselves that it brings a deeper, more reliable kind of happiness. So last, but certainly not least, we come to the Four Noble Truths at the end of the fourth foundation, at the end of all four foundations. And Luisa is going to talk more about this in detail next week, but I'll just make some general comments. Because this sutta and our whole spiritual practice really culminates in confirmation of the Four Noble Truths. Every other subject of mindfulness discussed in the sutta so far is really building up for this. It's leading to this insight. One of my Burmese teachers calls confirmation of the Four Noble Truths the cherished goal. The cherished goal. There's actually this really elegant progression of topics just within the fourth foundation, all of which leads up to and supports this one final conclusion of the Four Noble Truths. So it starts off with the forces of mind that cause suffering, the five hindrances. And if we can learn to see these forces at work for ourselves, then we're well on our way to understanding the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. Then we move on to the impersonal elements, composing our personalities and our lives, the five aggregates and the six sense bases. These are the aspects of our experience that we cling to, that we hang on to as somehow belonging to, or pertaining to, or defining ourselves. And if we can learn to see that process of clinging to what it is, the misinterpretation of all these impersonal elements as personal, then we're well on our way to understanding the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. And then finally, we arrive at the forces of the mind that bring an end to suffering, the seven factors of enlightenment. And the more we can see for ourselves how these mental forces actually free the mind from suffering, the closer we get to understanding the third noble truth, that there actually is an end to suffering that's possible. And to seeing the fourth noble truth and understanding the path that leads to the end of that suffering. So confirming this fifth and final doctrine of the Four Noble Truths really depends heavily on direct insight into the first four doctrines that show up in the Fourth Foundation, which in turn depends heavily on developing the first three foundations of mindfulness that came before those. So there's this really beautiful progression that captures the natural progress of our mindfulness practice in a really brilliant way. We all start off mostly struggling with suffering in our meditation, but gradually we move towards less identification with our personalities, less identification with our experience, more insight into their deeper nature, their true nature and personality, until finally we arrive at the flowering of true wisdom, the experience of deep peace. And I really love how just even the structure and organization of the sutta is in itself a teaching. So that's what I have to say tonight about the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And I hope you found something interesting in it. And I wish that you may all realize great benefits from your practice.